Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you're having a great day, regardless of what time it is, and that you're feeling good about what is ahead of you, whatever it may be. I did a recent poll and learned that listeners would prefer episodes at a bi-weekly cadence. So for the next season, I'm going to be experimenting with a bi-weekly release schedule. Today, you are in for a treat. The following episode will explore themes of being put on the spot, high impact networking, and sparking connections. Listen to learn how to start and stop event conversations, make a cogent pitch, and understand a tough audience. You will love hearing from Matt. Matt Abrahams is a leading expert in the field of communication. As a lecturer in organizational behavior at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business, he teaches popular classes in strategic communication and effective virtual presenting and has received the school's Alumni Teaching Award. Matt also teaches public speaking and co-teaches improvisationality speaking in the Stanford Continuing Studies program. When he isn't teaching, Matt is a highly sought-after keynote speaker and communications consultant and coach. He's helped numerous presenters prepare for high-stakes talks, including IPO roadshows, Nobel Prize award presentations, and appearances at TED and the World Economic Forum. His online talks garner millions of views, and he hosts the popular award-winning podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. His book, Speaking Up Without Freaking Out, 50 Techniques for Confident and Compelling Presenting, has helped a wide audience manage speaking anxiety and present more confidently and authentically. To relax and rejuvenate, Matt enjoys hiking with his wife, talking and watching sports with his kids, hanging out with his friends, and being continually humbled at the karate dojo. Now let's get started.
Hey listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue unlocks the potential of your entire donor pyramid. But how? Why, by giving fundraising teams the tools they need to personalize outreach at scale. Wow. And to inspire fundraising teams along the way, we offer Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub. Evertrue Studios is like Netflix, but for advancement. And we publish new podcast and video content every week. It's all free and all created with fundraisers in mind. Subscribe for weekly content from the Development Debrief podcast and other advancement thought leaders at evertrue.com/studios.
Hi, Matt. Welcome to the debrief.
Hello. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
I've been looking forward to this recording all day. So you were actually recommended to come onto this podcast, and I'm so grateful that you were, because we have so many synergies in the conversations that we're having. You also have a podcast, which I really enjoyed listening to, and it gave me a lot of energy and inspiration. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we work hard on Think Fast, Talk Smart to keep the content quick and crisp and hopefully helpful. So glad you found value.
So that's actually what we're here to talk about, is your book and your work in strategic communications. Mm-hmm. If I got this right, you started the podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart, and then it turned into a book. Is that right?
So yes, the podcast has been around for 3.5 years. We've built up a nice audience. We really focus on helping people hone and develop their communication. One of the topics of the podcast has been something that I've been working on for many, many years, on how to speak better in the moment, what I call spontaneous speaking. And we've done a number of our almost 100 episodes on that topic. But the podcast covers many other topics beyond what the book is about. They have a similar name. I'm not very creative. So the podcast is Think Fast, Talk Smart. The book is Think Faster, Talk Smarter. But both are geared to help people be better at communicating.
I've listened to a few episodes, and I think I'm going to end up listening to all of them because they are just so applicable to our work. And I have a series of questions for you. Sure. But I want to start in the macro with a really open question, which is, why do we wince when we are put on the spot?
I love the way you frame that. And I think for many of us, it's more than just wincing. It's total panic. When we are put on the spot, a whole collision of things happen for us. One, we get very nervous. It is very normal and natural. It's part of the human condition to be nervous when we feel intense pressure put on us. So we've got fight or flight initiated. At the same time, most of us want to do very well in these circumstances. So we have these high expectations for ourselves. So we're self-monitoring, judging, and evaluating ourselves. And in many cases, we feel like that there's a right way to do it. When somebody asks a question, we feel there's a right answer. When somebody asks for feedback in the moment, we feel like there's a right bit of feedback. So there's this collision of all this pressure that falls upon us to make these situations very challenging. And the nice thing is that with a little bit of practice and a little bit of rethinking the situation, working on our mindset, we can actually do a lot better in these circumstances.
So as you know, our audience is primarily fundraisers. Oftentimes in our roles, we are, well, all the time, we're put in the moment with donors, whether it's a donor meeting or we're networking at an event, or we are public speaking. Just last week, I made some brief remarks to a room of a little bit over 100 people.
Yeah.
So when we are public speaking, is it right to think about it as a performance?
No, simple answer. So we actually get ourselves into trouble when we see it as a performance. To me, a performance is something that has a right way and a wrong way to do it. If you think about it, actors perform, singers perform, athletes perform. And in all of those endeavors, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And I've been doing this communication work for decades now, and I'm here to tell you and all your listeners, there is no right way to communicate. There are better ways and worse ways. So when we put this added pressure on ourselves to do it right, we actually make it much more difficult for ourselves. So you will go a much farther way towards achieving your goals if you actually focus on connecting, being in the moment, listening, doing what's needed, rather than trying to say it exactly right. There are circumstances certainly where the words really do matter and they have to be spoken in exactly the right way. But many of your listeners, most of us in our daily lives, that's not the life we live. If you're a politician, if you're a negotiator, if you're a lawyer, there might be wording might really, really matter. But mm-hmm. for most of us, it's all about connecting rather than just trying to do it right.
And if I understand some of the things you've written on this before, the reason for that is because we let down, right? So we're demonstrating a more relaxed outward look when we're not going word for word. And then that demonstrates credibility. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. So essentially, it boils down to cognitive bandwidth. You know, your brain in some ways is like a computer. It's not a perfect analogy. But if you've got a phone or a computer open and you're running lots of apps or have lots of tabs open, your central processing unit is not running as efficiently as it can. We've all noticed when things slow down. The same thing is true with our brains. If I am constantly monitoring and judging every single thing I say, it reduces the bandwidth I have to actually say what I want to say well. So we actually need to reduce that pressure. Now, I am certainly not saying we shouldn't judge and evaluate what we say. We have to. I mean, success depends on targeting messages appropriately. But if we can dial that down just a little bit, turn the volume down on that performance mentality, that doing mm-hmm. it right, then it frees us up to connect. It puts all of our effort forward into getting the message across. You know, I teach at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. I teach strategic communication. I've done that for starting my 13th year now. I have the audacity to start my very first class by telling my students to strive for mediocrity. And their jaws drop. I mean, these students have never been told just to be
what?
Yeah, exactly. But the rationale is exactly what you and I have been talking about. If you just focus on getting it done, you actually free up cognitive resources to do it really well. When you put all this pressure on yourself, you make it harder to do well. So that's really what's going on behind the scenes. So it's really giving ourselves permission just to do it. We know what we need to say. And in so doing, we'll end up doing it well.
You know, 9 times out of 10, when I'm public speaking, I don't use notes and I just memorize my points. And I've found that that's exactly what you're talking about, where it's like, these are the things I'm trying to say, but it doesn't matter how I say them. And that helps me to be more in the moment.
Yeah, I am. That's wonderful. And congratulations. I am not a big fan of memorizing of any kind, just because it feeds into that loop I was talking about, that judging and evaluating. But I like having a path. I'm a big fan of structure. We might get to talk about that in a bit, but structure really helps you. It gives you a roadmap. What I do personally is I don't memorize anything, but what I'll do is I'll outline my remarks, and then I come up with questions that are cues and reminders of what I want to say. So I might even speak those questions. So if I were actually fundraising, I might say, tonight I'd really like to answer three fundamental questions for you about why this institution or this event is important. And then I'll literally say the question and I'll answer it. So I'm putting myself through a Q&A, if you will, but I feel much more comfortable in that dialogic event Q&A versus presenting. So I love what you do. I do a version of it. I just don't memorize the questions. I just have them in mind and go for it.
Let's take a step back and talk about social context.
Yeah.
You mentioned how important it is to take that moment and to soak up the social context that you're in. So I'd love to focus on it in thinking about one-on-one donor visits and then those event settings. So what are the things that people should take that moment of mindfulness to be noticing, cueing in before they get started?
So that's a great question, and I really appreciate it. And something we are always rushing. We rush into presentations, meetings, and then we rush out of them. Taking a moment to just really check in with yourself. Where am I at? To ground yourself, to be present in the moment can really help. And taking a deep belly breath is a great way to do that. You can do that before you join a virtual meeting. You can do that before you enter into a room. When you're in the room, notice just the dynamics of what's going on. Where are people sitting or standing? Are people coming from multiple meetings? Are you the fifth speaker or the first speaker? These are all things that can inform you about your audience's readiness and willingness to focus on what you're saying. You might notice how people are interacting with each other, or maybe they're not. Maybe they're all on their phones. This all gives you insight into what's important for them in the moment and perhaps what you should do to start. So if everybody's all excited and talking with each other, imagine you're starting at the end of a networking event or a dinner and it's your turn to speak. Your approach might be to get people to calm down, to get people to focus. It might be the opposite, where everybody's on their phones or not interacting. And then your focus needs to be bringing that attention together and getting that energy going. So if we come in with one plan and the environment is not what that plan is meant for, it can not only induce more stress, but it increases the likelihood you won't be as successful. So taking that moment to reflect about yourself and what's going on in the environment can be really helpful.
I think that's such a good takeaway from this episode in general. I think that we plan, and there are so many things that are out of our control. So if we go in with this really specific expectation, it can be easy to get knocked off your guard or scrambled in your ideas. So I love this notion of meeting the person where they are.
That's right. And taking the time to... Yeah, and take the time to just notice that. We often have all these things we want to get across, and it doesn't matter if the person isn't open and receptive to it.
Yeah. So. One of the things that I forget too often, and then every time I remember, I am curious about it, the Bill Clinton effect, right? Of how when you meet someone, they make you feel like you're the only person in the room. They make you feel good. And this quote of people won't remember what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel.
Yes. Maya Angelou. Yes.
Yeah. How can we be aware of that? How can we be aware of making people feel welcomed and important, like their gift matters and that they're an important part of our community?
Yeah, well, so part of it is just human to human connection. I believe that we all have this ability to connect. We just have to take the time to do it. So in terms of some tactics, You know, two, I would like to suggest. One is asking questions. You know, if you were in a sales role, salespeople are always taught listen more than speak. And a great way to listen is to tee up questions. So what are some questions that could really help you connect with the individual to demonstrate that you are caring and interested? In my new book, I do a whole section on small talk, because small talk is a very challenging spontaneous speaking situation. And I interview this a really cool person. Her name's Rachel Greenwald. She's an academic, but also a matchmaker, which is a really interesting combination. Wow. Yeah. And she does a lot around small talk. And she said, your goal in small talk, your goal in these kind of interactions you're talking about is to be interested, not interesting. And I think that's really helpful, because a lot of us put a pressure on ourselves to be interesting. But if you're interested, you're doing things like asking clarifying questions. You're paraphrasing. I think paraphrasing is such an underutilized tool to really signal that you're listening and that what somebody is saying is important. And to paraphrase, it doesn't mean you repeat word for word what they say, but you highlight the gist of what they've said. So if somebody's sharing with you what's really important to them, you can listen and paraphrase and say, so I hear that the arts are something that's been an important part of your life. And I'm really glad you're here, because we have part of this whole organization focuses on the arts. That paraphrase not just validates, I heard what you're saying, but also gives you the opportunity, if you misheard something, for the other person to correct you. So I think questioning, I think paraphrasing, I think putting a priority on connection really make a difference.
Yeah, it sounds like that's a little bit of a mirroring technique of repeating mm-hmm. back what they're saying to make sure they've heard you.
Yeah, so mirroring is appropriate, and we do mirroring in what we say, but also non-verbally. But paraphrasing to me is a little bit more than that. You're extrapolating the gist and putting it into your own words, and then paraphrasing never happens by itself. It always is followed by something. So it might be a question. It might be linking back to something that was already said. If you're doing it in a meeting, it might be moving forward to the next meeting item. So mirroring is important. The key to mirroring is not to do it so it's so blatant that people can tell that you're doing it. This notion of paraphrasing, I think, is more subtle.
So many of us hate small talk, and we say, let's skip the small talk because it doesn't matter. But you're saying that it's important. Why is it important?
I think small talk gets a huge bad rap. I actually think that we need to do a big rebranding of small talk. So I think really big things can happen during small talk. For you personally, it's an opportunity to connect. It's an opportunity to explore and find other people who have similar interests. It's an opportunity to learn and grow. And yet we don't like it because it's mostly awkward and we don't know how to do it. And so, you know, the biggest problems with small talk are getting into it and getting out of it.
So if you
go in with curiosity and discussing things that are in the environment, you know, you don't have to be amazingly scintillating and really powerfully connected. You can just go in and notice something in the room. I just this last weekend was at an opportunity to do a little chit chat before this conference started. And I noticed that 9 out of 10 people in the room were all wearing blue shirts. And I went up to somebody I didn't know. And I said, did I miss the memo on the blue shirts? and the person laughed because they hadn't noticed. And then all of a sudden we started talking, and that's all it took. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to avoid the doom loop of how are you, right? How are you? And great. And then we don't go anywhere. So picking out something that's interesting and unique, commenting on what preceded the event or what comes after it, asking a question, those are all ways to start, and they're all low stakes. And they give you something to follow up on, because you can always ask a follow-up question. Now, getting out is tricky also. Many of us exit spontaneous speaking by relying on essentially biology. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I have to go to the bathroom, right? And so, Rachel Greenwald, again, taught me this technique that I love. She calls it the white flag approach. And it's not white flag like I surrender. It's, if you know anything about auto racing, before the final lap, they will wave the white flag to signal to everybody the race is ending. You can do the same thing in small talk. And I love this advice. as you're beginning to wrap up your conversation, you signal it. You say, I'm hungry, or there's somebody over there I'd like to talk to. But before I go, I've got this one last question for you, or I'd like to follow up on something you said earlier. So you use it as an opportunity to signal that, hey, we're going to end this conversation, but not at this moment. And you continue the conversation, just one more question, one more little exchange. And then at the end, you say, thank you very much. I'm going to head over there. It is such a smoother way to exit. Everybody's prepared. It's not awkward. It's polite because you're setting expectations. I have tried it. I love it. I recommend everybody use it.
Yeah, just as hard as it is, I think it is almost harder to end, because I find that at events, if you find someone that you're comfortable with, it's easy to just sort of stay with them in safety and not move around. But it's really important for us to work the whole room. And I was recently talking with a colleague who compared it to a bee pollinating.
Little
stints around the room. And that's what we ideally want to do. But it's that getting away that we don't want to feel like we're being rude to end things or to walk away from someone. So I really love that tip.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It can feel awkward, but the tip actually really helped. That using the white flag approach makes it feel so much less awkward.
To transition away from the event talk, I read in your book, there was a cold calling experiment at Stanford, and watching people on the phone on the spot gave you a lot of indicators around the discomfort. What were the can you tell us more about that experiment and what your takeaways were?
Well, so cold calling is really, it's tough, right? Because you put yourself out there and it's easy to feel rejected.
And we have to do it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Part of what I talk about in the first part of the book's divided into two parts. One is really a methodology for speaking in the moment. And the second is very specific examples of it, like Q&A, like small talk, et cetera. So one of the big sections of the book is talking about mindset. And part of what really helps in cold call situations is to reframe the whole circumstance. One, it's not rejection. There are lots of reasons people don't pick up or don't follow up or don't stay connected to you. So that's one thing. The other thing is to look for the opportunity in these moments. And the opportunity might be that you're planting a seed now that will come to fruition later. You know, you have an immediate need now. You might not be getting that, but you might have made a connection where somebody will hear of your organization or hear of the value you provide, and that will lead them in the future to think something about it. So part of what we learned in the work that we did is that reframing these situations as immediate versus giving them a little longer term can be really helpful. And there's a mentality that comes from the research on growth mindset. Carol Dweck has done amazing work in this field. And part of what she talks about is this not yet mentality. So not yet just means it didn't happen now, but it doesn't mean it won't happen and can't happen. And if you embrace that, it can also take a lot of that pressure off. Because part of what makes these cold calls difficult is we enter them highly amped up or stressed, and then we don't connect in the way that we can. So part of it's on us, and part of it's the people we're talking to. They're just not ready either. So anything we can do to reframe that circumstance is one that can reduce stress and invite us to connect more can really help.
That's so interesting, because I rely probably more heavily on email, and I've been trying to set up meetings in New York City and been emailing lots of potential people to visit with. And it was August, a lot of people were away, and it was frustrating. But then what I realized was my next trip is all queued up, right? Because they said, let me know about next time. And that did plant that seed. So it just shows that the work is iterative and that it's not a one-off. So it's similar.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I have two colleagues, Suchi Huang and Jennifer Ocker, and they study lots of interesting things. But one study they did is they call it the journey mindset. So instead of being fixated on the goal, the end of the journey, if you focus on the actual journey itself, the experience itself, and what it sets you up for, you actually tend to be more committed, you tend to like it more, and you often tend to be more successful. So what you're essentially saying is what the research found is that you're now using that communication to set you up for what's next. And that's part of that journey. And that can be actually much more motivational than, oh, just got one, right? So yes. that's great that you're doing that.
When I do my email outreach, I'm really conscious of keeping the email short. Mm. I want it to be 3 or 4 sentences. I introduce yes. who I am, I say what I want to do, and I end it with a question.
Yes.
Why is brevity so important? I think that we, in our nervousness, want to add a lot of details in, but it's counterproductive. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, my mother has this saying, she didn't create it, but I love it. It's tell me the time, don't build me the clock. And a lot of us are clock builders when we communicate, because we want people to appreciate and understand the logic behind our points or what we're yes. trying to say. We want that to demonstrate that we're intelligent, and here's this wealth of knowledge that we have. But the reality is, being concise is really important. And more as our attention is being competed for in so many different ways, concision, being concise, is super important. And one way to be more concise, there are 3 major ways to do it. One is to be really focused on your goal. What is it you are trying to achieve? And to me, a goal has 3 parts: information, emotion, and action. So it's not just the information you're trying to get across. How are you trying to make people feel? Are you trying to make them excited or concerned or confident? And then what's the action? Make sure that's very clear. So you have to have that defined, because that helps you prioritize what to say. If I know my goal, I can better prioritize towards it. The other thing we have to remember is what helps us be concise is we have to be thinking about what's relevant to the person I'm talking to. What's relevant to you as the communicator might not be exactly the same as what's relevant to the person you're talking to. And if you focus on what's relevant to them, that will also help you be more concise. And then the final way is to be structured. Structure is so important. We often list or itemize things, and listing and itemizing does not help us. Instead, you want to make sure that you are actually structured. There's a logical connection. A structure to me is nothing more than a logical connection of ideas. May I share a pitching structure that I love that's really helpful for coming up with a really concise structure and message? Would that
please,
be okay?
Please.
Okay. So I talk about this in the book as a bonus structure when I talk about influence and persuasion. And this structure really helps you get to a tight elevator pitch for what you're trying to say. It's 4 sentence starters. So you just finish these sentences. So the first is, what if you could? What if you could? The second is, so that. The third is, for example. And the final is, and that's not all. So I encourage all of your listeners to think about whatever organization that they're trying to raise funds for. Finish, what if you could, so that, for example, and that's not all. So I happen to be a board member for a nonprofit. Part of my job is to help raise money. Can I use an example of the structure for that nonprofit? Would that be okay?
I'm dying to hear.
Okay. So it's called Silicon Valley, where I live, Urban Debate League. So we actually provide funds and schooling for underrepresented youth to learn communication skills through speech and debate. Who knew that if you teach kids how to communicate better and critically think better, they do better in school? Very logical. So if I were to use this structure, these 4 sentence starters, it would be, what if you could equip all students with the ability to think critically and communicate so that they could perform better at school and be more likely to succeed in college? For example, we are operating in 8 different school districts where we are teaching curriculum around speech and debate in schools that did not have programs like that before. And that's not all. These students go on to careers that allow them to give back to their communities and help rise up other students who are like they were in school. Do you hear how just those 3-4 sentence starters actually get you to a very clear and concise pitch? The what if you could paints a picture of the future, so that makes it relevant. The for example grounds it in reality, something that's happening. And that's not all allows you to paint the future of what could be beyond where you currently are today. So I love this structure. I find it very useful. And I would challenge everybody listening to whatever you're raising funds for, talk through that structure, and it helps. And if you're part of a team, have each person do it. Come together and then use it as a way of refining your message so you're consistent within your teams.
That's great. So thank we you. Used the brevity. We got the meeting, whether we did the cold call or the email, we're prepared, we're ready. And then we sit down with someone who is taking no prisoners. I read a quote, it said, the person with the most challenging question is most likely our champion. I have had that experience so many times where I'm getting asked question after question about the endowment, the finances, every detail about the strategic plan, the leadership. Sometimes I knew the answer, sometimes I didn't, but my back is up against the wall. Why is it that that person who seems so unsure and so hesitant, our biggest champion?
Well, so I actually encourage people to embrace those who are most challenging for them, because they care. Those are the people who are passionate. Those are the people who like you, have some real emotion for whatever the topic is or the organization is. So I look forward to that in those circumstances. Now, many of us feel like we have to defend ourselves, or we're being challenged or threatened, and it can feel that way. But in fact, if you see these as opportunities and look for areas to connect and collaborate, you can change the whole dynamic. And so really looking for where you align with the person who's being difficult or opposing. It could be that you both agree that the arts are really important, but one thinks we should fund education programs and the other thinks we should fund restoration, for example. Great, you have alignment on the arts are important. Let that as a launching point to look at how we can find ways to work together. So I understand why these things feel threatening, because the person is in your face, or they're expressing themselves very dynamically. But those are the people I want to be communicating with. It is the person who is apathetic, the person who doesn't care, the person who doesn't respond. That to me is the most challenging person to deal with. So I look at those as great. You know, when I have a student who challenges me, I lean in. For the book, I interviewed a prominent comedian. And because comedians get heckled all the time. I mean, can you imagine a worse situation where somebody, and they embrace heckler, because there's something there, there's magic, there's energy, right? In that moment that you can leverage to collaborate and connect. And I encourage everybody to do that.
Yeah, I was so happy to see you put that in there, because that really has been my experience. And when I was earlier on in this work, it used to really make me nervous, but now I've seen through going through it enough times that those are the prospects that sometimes we want to be focusing on.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. Totally.
So you talk a bit about reputation. I think reputation is really important in the context of us representing our institutions, in the context of us working a certain constituency base, let's say whether it's regional or it's a reunion class, people talk. And if you can build a good relationship, they're going to tell their friends that they should meet with you. They're going to open doors for you and recommend things. So you had a really cool quote from one of the people you interviewed about reputation, but let's talk about that a bit.
Yeah. So Alison Kluger teaches a class at the Stanford Graduate School of Business where I teach on reputation and reputation management. And reputation is really important. She calls it the echo that enters the room before you do, right? And I love that notion of an echo. Mm-hmm. So it can help you. It can challenge you. But we need to be thinking about the reputation that we are representing. And the key ideas and points that we want to get across. I mean, reputation and brand are very related. And so you need to think about what are the key drivers of the brand and reputation of the institution or organization or group that you're representing, and what can you do to reinforce those? How can you connect to those? And also, remember, this is a long game. It's not just the immediate ask or the immediate event. It goes way beyond that. So as you are trying to have the interaction, maybe make the ask for money or for involvement and engagement, be thinking not just in the short term, but long term, because it can impact the reputation for sure. And reputation isn't just what you say, it's how you act, it's the environment that you put people in. You know, I'm a big fan of meeting invites. I think people so poorly use invitations. We just use them to get information out, you know, the logistics, tactical things. How you make the invitation, when you make the invitation, what you call the meeting, if you're sending out an electronic meeting invite, all of that impacts people's perceptions of you and the organization and impact your reputation. So take the time to think about the little things as well. And I say that not to stress people out, but to there are lots of levers that you have around reputation, and you need to pull them to be successful.
Yeah, there's something, you know, I don't use meeting invitations that often. In fact, I usually don't send them unless someone asks me to, which is kind of interesting. Maybe I should try to do it more, because it does create a sense of safety. It's like, well, I know it's on the other person's calendar, so they're going to see it. And so this meeting is definitely confirmed. But the other thing I thought of when you were talking was something as simple as making a reservation for the meal of wherever you're going. It shows that you planned ahead for the person, and it's a level of hospitality.
Absolutely. And care and concern, you know, so this is a little off tangent, but it gets to exactly the same point where it enhances your credibility. You know, if you put a meeting invite and you're using Zoom or Teams or Meet or whatever, and you just put in the invite and say, and as part of this meeting, we'll be using the whiteboard feature, and here's a link to a YouTube training on how to use the whiteboard feature. Even if everybody knows how to use it, just by virtue of you putting that in the invite that shows you're so concerned that somebody might not know and that would be awkward, that bolsters your credibility. And for somebody who doesn't know, it certainly helps them. So it's little things like that that make a huge difference in people's perceptions. And they might not even be able to articulate that. They might not even say, hey, it was because you put that outline in the invitation, but it's just this overall feeling that they get. And that's really important.
Yeah. Another example I can give, you know, I'm in the first 3-4 months of a new job. And so I've been getting a lot of recommendations on other people to meet on campus or in the community. And one of the things I've been sure to do is to circle back on to the recommender to say, I had this meeting and it was so great, and here's why. Thank you. That's a really another good example of building reputation, I think.
I think that's great. Yes, absolutely. If somebody connects you to somebody, you should thank them and explain that how you benefited from it. I think that's great. These are things that take a little bit of time, but they certainly go a long way in helping you.
Yeah. That these are good examples, because I know people love examples. And you know, the reputation thing, it's daunting. It's not, does this person like me or not? Right. It's different. I think it goes a little bit to how you make someone feel, like we were talking about earlier, and credibility.
No, I absolutely think that how you make someone feel really makes a difference in how you can succeed and what how it all works for you and for them.
So you wrote the book in 7 months. Can you tell us a little bit about your process of writing the book and getting all of this pen to paper? Because again, one of the things that I really enjoy about the messaging that you're putting out in your podcast is that it's all so relatable and things in our daily lives, but you're putting words and names to all of these interactions. So would love to hear how that came about.
So I actually do not like writing. I would much rather speak than write. Writing is hard for me.
I'm the same way.
Yeah. And we're in the minority. A lot of people would say, I'd much rather write than speak, but I feel differently. So the process was hard. Now, the nice thing is, because of the podcast I do, the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast, because I've been teaching for so long, parts of this I've been mulling over and working on for a long time. I'm a big fan of having editors and help along the way. I'm a big fan of collaboration. Most of the courses I teach, I collaborate with. When I write, I collaborate. So it was through collaboration and iteration that it worked. But, you know, just like I advise people when they write presentations or set up meetings, chunking things out. So having a logical structure and working piece by piece was much easier for me than looking at the whole thing to get all together. That's very daunting. So those are the things that really helped. And I believe in rapid prototyping. So as soon as I had a draft done, I would be iterating on it. You know, each chapter in the book, I probably iterated it. The fewest iterations was probably 5. So I believe in getting things out and iterating. And I think that helps with any kind of messaging, be it a book, be it a talk, be it a meeting, be it a pitch, iterate and make those changes.
Yeah, it gives it a life of its own in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it helps you make sure you're doing the right thing. Yes.
Well, I feel like we've just gotten a taste. And like I said, I'm definitely going to be listening to more of your episodes and certainly reading the book. I was able to read some sections, but looking forward to seeing the whole thing. And I hope others will check it out. How can they find your book and your podcast?
Thank you so much. So the podcast is wherever you get your podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart. The book is listed anywhere and everywhere books are sold. It comes out end of September. And you can find me on LinkedIn or go to mattabrahams.com. I have lots of resources, lots of video to help anybody interested in improving their communication. And we have lots of things on influence, persuasion that would help your specific audience. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Of course. And just like you, I have a signature question. So I'd love to end with that, which is, what do you know for sure?
I know for sure that people can improve their communication and feel more comfortable and confident doing it. And as a result, have a bigger impact on the world. I know that for sure. I've seen it in my own life. I've seen it in the life of my students, the people I coach, and the people that listen to the podcast that I host. So I know that for sure. And I'm passionate about helping people achieve it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is no surprise Matt has won awards for excellence in teaching. He really has a way of breaking these concepts down and helping them be clear and understandable. Thank you for listening to this episode. I'm hoping that you feel fired up and excited to attend your next event, preparing for your next visit, or just making a presentation in your personal or professional life. I'm hoping that you feel more confident to take on what can be a very anxiety-inducing task. If you're new to the podcast, please connect with me on LinkedIn or follow on Instagram at devdebrief. I would love to hear from you. We'll be back with the next episode in 2 weeks.